Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets where some minor corrections were made. Gold and especially silver have been charging higher, and uranium had a good week. Editor of Rick's Picks, Rick Ackerman, joins us from San Francisco, a city he says has gone into serious decline. Rick gives us some targets for the S&P, gold, and silver. He's also not a big fan of AI, and he tells us why. The publisher of the Schachter Energy Report, Joseph Schachter, checks in from Calgary to talk about his upcoming energy conference October 18th, the outlook for crude and natural gas, and whether AI processing centers will drain the grid. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Ross, how would you describe what happened on the stock markets this week?
Well, you know, we got a little bit of a hiccup early in the week, pulled back in the S&P and the NASDAQ. But we've been walking up here with corrections down to the 20-day moving average, half a dozen times now since April. And this was another one as of the middle of this week, holding its support. Clearly, the rallies now, there's a rotation going on, and, the real speculative issues have really come to life here in the last few weeks. And, you're seeing more of that. And then within the Mag 7, they've slowed down, but there's still enough price action here to pull things higher. And just walking up now, as I say, from a seasonal perspective, stretch that we're coming into here, the end of September, starts to get a little bit iffy. So now instead of watching the support that we had at the on the pullback at the 1st of September, we need to be watching the one that we just put in this week. So that's where I sit. And rather than second guessing it, I'm just going to let the market identify the turn when it happens.
What's going on with gold?
Gold, we've been stair-stepping up over there, and the interesting thing is that, you know, we had that consolidation for months and months, had a nice breakout, and then ran and had another period of consolidation here about two, three weeks ago. And broke out once again to the upside. Now, we were overbought 2-3 weeks ago, and usually at that point, the degree to which we'd overbought, you'd expect a decent correction. When you don't have that correction, then you start to get into the exponential mode, and that's like 1979. You know, we ran from 420 up to 850 in a span of, 2 months. Got broken out as it broke out of the 420 range, and had just literally like 3 to 4 day pauses on the way to 850. We're in that mode right now where we're getting this acceleration to the upside, and the key now is that you want to watch the very short term pullbacks. And see if they hold above the previous highs in terms of where the resistance was. So as of this week, we're telling people that 3,700 on the cash price is the key number that you need to be looking at. During the middle of this week, we had a correction back towards 37 and a quarter. We're finishing off the week nice and strong. So I think you look at that 3,700 level as a key support. Now, the real flyer within precious metals is the silver market. And we got the breakout on the RSI back in May on the long-term charts. And that was indicative then of the beginning of a move that would take us to a five-year cycle high, which is due then in the second quarter of next year. So it's got just lots of running room from a time perspective. And from a pricing perspective, the RSI, currently sitting at about 82, is getting high. But when we look at the ADX, which is the average directional movement indicator, so that's strength of trend, that's only around 26, which is indicative of a constructive market, but not an excessive one. You need that ADX to get up around 40 or higher to become excessive, and that's going to take quite a while to happen. So if we look at back at five-year cycle highs on silver, once you get the higher ADX number up pushing around 40 with an RSI up around 80 to 85, that is indicative of the top. So at 81 right now on the RSI, we could be looking at a very short-term spike up in terms of a high here in the next couple of weeks. But the bigger trend, the larger one to be watching for, will be into the second quarter of next year. So this is a good week, not just for the bullion itself, but silver miners and the juniors are really coming into play. And I think you want to just sit back and enjoy the run, because it is one of those things you only see, you know, say, on average once every 5 years. And this one has got lots of momentum behind it right now.
What's happening with crude?
Crude, you know, I've been sitting back thinking that, you know, we could end up with a bit of a seasonal break in here, but that's not happening. The support level around 62 has held, and we've pushed this week back up to around 65.5, which is the high that we saw at the early part of the month. It's probably looking more constructive right now than I thought. I still don't see it as a viable trade. You know, there might be some strength here, but, you know, I'd rather look for a seasonal low sometime in November, December to really be participating in anything on the crude oil market.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Good action here as far as the U.S. dollar is concerned. We had that test of the July lows in September. We went down, and depending upon whether you're looking at the cash market or the futures market, it just made a nominally lower low and then turned on a dime. So that's called a spring, when you just take out that support and immediately make the reversal. So a week ago, it got up to the first resistance level, which is around 97.5 on the dollar index. And, you know, we were looking at it as a potential bottom, and what it needed to do is start to close above the resistance levels. And that is now taking place. So the dollar index, having been at its lowest low at the beginning or the middle of September, as we push into the end of the month, is now pushing against the August highs, and it truly looks as though this is a decent base in as far as the dollar is concerned, and it's got lots of potential, I think, on the upside. The 101 level would be a reasonable first target to be looking at. We're sitting at, you know, just over 98, I think about 98.20 as we push into the end of the week here, but there's good upside action there. And other currencies, just pretty much across the board, are showing excellent topping action, and we're seeing them push towards lower lows, the lowest that we've seen since July. In taking out those supports, I think you want to be looking at some pretty sizable declines ahead. And, you know, that's the Canadian dollar is right up there with the rest of them in terms of its negativity. The most recent moves that we've seen on the upside now in crude oil and in the CRB index show big divergence relative to the Canadian dollar. When the dollar does not rally with those two items, and then you that type of divergence will set up for extended breaks on the upside. So, or extended breaks on the downside. And in this case, you know, we're probably on the verge of something pretty significant. So, you know, stay away from the Canadian dollar. U.S. dollar looks like a pretty safe haven when you look at just about everything else out there.
Did uranium do well this week?
Yes. Excellent week for uranium. The spot price is sort of on a run right now the last few days, and it's been led actually ahead of that move by the uranium stocks. The indices like the URA had good corrections in August, big buy signals there. And, you know, here the URA ETF was down at 36 and change. Now we're at 48 and change on a little three-day pullback. This thing has just got excellent price action. If you look at the juniors, the safe type of thing, you know, we've gone from 20 up to 30 in a span of, what, since, you know, third week of August. So lots of upside momentum here. Small corrections should be looked at as buying opportunities, but you know, when you look at the fundamentals as far as uranium's concerned down the road here, 5, 10, 20 years, this is one of those areas that you want to just, you know, have and continue to hold.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Rick Ackerman, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for inviting me on, Jim. It's always a pleasure to connect with you guys.
The stock markets continue to hit new highs. We're almost into October. Do you have targets for the stock markets as we go into what's traditionally been a tricky time of year?
I do have targets, actually. My target for the E-mini S&Ps is about 1.5, maybe 1.6% above current levels, which is 6688. So, you know, I mean, I've been saying, hey, we're almost there for 15 years. So you never want to bet too heavily that you're going to see the mother of all tops. But I would say we're within 1.5% of something that's going to produce some kind of tradable top.
Gold's hitting new highs. Do you have targets for gold?
Yeah, I put out, I raised the target. Gold has been blowing through lesser, what I call, hidden pivot resistances. And I'm at, I think, current target for the December COMEX contract is about, what is it, 44,200, and I believe it's 81. That's about $400. It's currently trading 3806, so we've got quite a bit of room there to the upside, but I'm pretty sure it's going to get there. The actual target is well, it's I'm looking at my own newsletter and astounded to see that I don't have it on the front page. The target's up at 4,200 and change.
Wow. Well, that's a very nice target. Anything on silver?
Yeah, silver just keeps blowing through every hidden pivot that I can put there. You know, we've been using for the last $4 or $5 of this rally a target up at 40. I think it was $45 and 80 some cents, but it looks like it's just going to keep going here. And I've raised the target in this would be the December contract to around $52. So it's just in a very powerful bull market. I've run out of hidden pivot targets on the longer interval charts, the longer term charts. So I'm stuck just kind of using extensions of patterns that are occurring on the rightmost edge of the chart. So silver, yeah, it finally looks like it's got something above 50 written all over it right now.
You're in San Francisco, boots on the ground. What are you seeing and observing?
It's interesting. You know, I read for years about the decline of the city. I lived here for 22 years myself, and I think I caught a very good time. It was certainly a time when you could have a lot of fun in San Francisco. Now you've got a lot of high-tech stiffs who they all kind of turn up in the same place every Friday and Saturday night in North Beach. But, you know, I took a long walk. It was from the convention center, the Moscone Center, all the way up to the Transamerica Pyramid. And it took me through the business district. And I can remember on a Friday when the stock market wrapped up business for the week, everybody would empty out into the surrounding neighborhood. And there were a lot of bars, a lot of great restaurants, but many of them are closed now. And the fascinating thing about downtown San Francisco is that there are virtually no tenants above the ground floor in any of these buildings. And I mean that's just literally true. There are no tenants in any buildings, and even at the ground level, retail is kind of struggling. So there are a lot of empty storefronts there, and I was also out in the Richmond neighborhood yesterday. There are two neighborhoods that extend all the way out to the ocean, and they're on either side of Golden Gate Park. One is the Richmond, one's the Sunset. And the park itself is a fabulous amenity, but I would say that the main east-west thoroughfare that takes you out to the ocean, it's called Geary Boulevard. Geary Boulevard is, it's really pretty seedy. You know, I would say the Richmond neighborhood has some real vitality, but it's really dirty. The streets are in horrible shape, but that's pretty much all over San Francisco. And there's no way that the workers are ever going to come back into the high-rise buildings. Occasionally, you'll get a phony story in a Wall Street Journal about companies are summoning their workers back to work, but that's a big fat lie. Whether they're summoning or not, the workers are not coming, and you're never going to have any significant reoccupancy of those buildings. So they're going to sit empty. And that's never happened in the history of civilization, where giant buildings that cost, you know, $1.5 to $3 billion to build are just sitting there empty. You really can't tear them down. And it's even more difficult to convert them into apartments. So they can't be converted. That's an impossibility. So they're just sitting there. And the landlords just sort of carry them all on the books at inflated prices. None of them have taken the hit, but when they do, it's going to be not a good thing for San Francisco.
Do you think San Francisco is one of the most liberal cities in the country?
Well, no question about it. You know, I went to a movie last night. It was called another battle or another war or something. And it was released in 2025. And it was kind of a bunch of revolutionaries, who were bombing everything. And then you had the ultra-right-wing paramilitaries kind of after them. And I found myself on the wrong side of the cheering section. You know, I was, as the movie progressed, I was hoping they would catch the revolutionaries, but I think I was the only one in the theater who felt that way. So San Francisco, in any public gathering that I've been to, which included Comedy Day in the Park, all of the jokes are at the expense of people on the right side, political right side of the divide. So San Francisco is pretty liberal. Of course, they look across the bay at Berkeley, where you see real, well, that's kind of liberalism at its most destructive. Berkeley has passed laws that in effect criminalize automobiles, and they've done everything they can to destroy parking space. And of course, it had the predictable result of crushing all the retail businesses in downtown Berkeley. So there's in Berkeley and San Francisco in particular, you've got pockets of very, very, very deep blue.
There's a lot of artificial intelligence hype. What do you think the future of AI is?
I think it's a lot of crap. The Journal does its story about, or I saw somewhere, well, here's a success story in AI. If you're looking for where the revenues, where are these companies that are investing money in AI going to make their money? And they had some company that was out there with a success story that was producing $1.5 million of revenues for them. But they are a kind of a rare exception in an industry that's attracting trillions. That's trillions of dollars of money. It's getting thrown at AI willy-nilly. There's too many mega billionaires with too grandiose expectations. They're not all going to get rich from AI. You know, the primary function of AI, the thing that's sort of pulling it through commercially, is its ability to put people out of work. But I challenge anybody to come up with anything AI is going to do that's going to net add jobs and add value, really. It makes things easier to do, but I don't think it's really going to get... I think the major application of AI is going to be in the area of porn. And you know, even if AI were to come up with a cure for cancer tomorrow, which it won't, what would the economic impact of that be? For one, they'd have to shut down the multi-trillion-dollar investment that's been made in the Texas Medical Center in Houston. You know, we've got all across the country, we've got dedicated healthcare and industry there that kind of goes back to the old methods, which are known colloquially as slash, burn, and poison, meaning surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy. So that all hasn't changed, and if AI changed it dramatically, I think it'd be great. We already know what the cure for cancer is, and that is that everybody stops eating lots of processed foods. And let's say it's a lifestyle change, and I doubt that AI is going to succeed politically in bringing that about. There's a lot of vested interest there. So, but putting aside healthcare and AI giving us a cure for Lou Gehrig's disease or whatever, I don't see where the money is. I just don't see the revenue stream. Or I don't know, but what do you think?
Well, you were the one who pointed out that autocorrect on your phone is a form of AI and how it messes up. The worst one for me was I texted a friend saying, I will soon be there, and it wrote, poop, poop, kill.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And the AI that we see, that we interface with each day in phone texts and things like that, it's got an IQ of 6. I mean, it's a disgrace. And if you talk to the carriers, mine is AT&T, and say, well, you know, AI concurrently, it can translate languages verbally and so on and so forth. Why can't it spell? Why can't it get a sentence right? Why does it have to put periods randomly in whatever you're dictating? It's horrible. It's an absolute disgrace, and it discredits all the people who are involved in it. So, you know, my question is, when is voice to text going to be other than disgraceful?
Well, you have to spend all your time going back and correcting all the mistakes. So how much time did you really save?
Right. And you know, supposedly that's true for coders as well. When AI is writing code, it leaves more than the usual number of vulnerabilities to hackers. And they also have to double check the work. And it winds up being, it's not nearly as efficient as proponents seem to suggest.
Yeah, that's one thing. When I learned how to code, I was very good at was finding mistakes, because I made a lot of them.
Well, AI makes a lot of mistakes too, and just having to check its work is a real drain on human resources. So I don't know. It doesn't really matter which industry you apply AI to. I don't see where it's making anybody any money. I mean, you could certainly replace lawyers with AI black boxes in a courtroom, because the little black box has the whole law library in its digital digit crunching head. But all right, so you put all the lawyers out of work. That's great. But you know, it doesn't matter which way you point. I don't see real important things happening with AI. And of course, you got all these people swearing that it's going to change everything and change the world. But what is changing is that, you know, you now can use a couple different applications. You can, as one marketing guy did, he took these bunny rabbits and he had them bouncing around on a trampoline. And the visually, it was so convincing that the debate was, is this for real? Are these real bunnies on a real trampoline? So the capability there to put virtually, we're already halfway there. You know, I won't even talk about the capability, but we're halfway there to putting everybody in creative fields out of work. And of course, you've got your cutting edge players in that. Disney, which is a bunch of scumbags, probably the least innovative company in America, and they're just, everybody is substituting AI creativity, or not creativity, just AI scripts, AI music, AI this, AI that, for the real thing. And of course, nobody can tell the difference anymore. Like, if you're listening to some girl band, who the heck knows whether it's real human beings or young ladies singing? They both stink, and nobody really knows who's doing it. And there's so much. I think someone said in the industry said that about a third of the music that's being streamed right now is not produced by humans. So we're already there. I mean, and I can see why the Hollywood the writers took such a hard line in their last strike. Not that it's going to save them, but they're already an endangered species, because you know, AI can write a script. It can't write a good script, but nobody needs good anymore. You know, passable is all you need.
What's going on in the crude oil market?
Nothing for months and years. You know, it's up 73 cents today, but crude is trading exactly where it was back in early 2024, actually 2023. You had a big dip in April of this year and a big rally in June. But most of it has been range trading. There's nothing going on in crude.
Anything going on with uranium?
Nope, I don't track uranium. Let me take a look. Actually, it well, Cameco. I don't know. See, let's see. Yeah, I mean, the uranium story has been around for so long that I've just kind of lost interest in it. You know, we are developing a technology for smaller plants, and the recycling of fissionable material is much better than it used to be. So there's some growth there, but it hasn't really engaged my attention.
Anything in the currencies market that caught your eye?
Well, just that the dollar, I think, is in an eternal bear market, a never-ending bear market. And that's pretty much the way Trump wanted it. It's odd that it's ironic that he should be pushing America first when the money system of America, he wants it to be last. So the dollar just keeps coming down, and we're always hearing about countries that are going to band together to take to unseat the dollar as the world's reserve currency. But the simple point that I always raise to trash that whole idea is how do you replace a financial edifice that tallies close to more than $2 quadrillion, all of it in U.S. dollars, or nearly all of it. So I don't know how you replace that. So it's not like the dollar is going away, no matter who wants that to happen. It really is. It is a true market of sorts.
Anything going on in the cannabis market?
Nope. Other than, you know, you can see that the states that have legalized that are so greedy that they're now getting, the looser the rules get, the more the black market tends to displace the official market. So in most places, you can buy marijuana cheaper on the streets than you can in, you know, from the stores.
Rick, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you for inviting me on.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Coming up, Joseph Schachter, next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report online at schachterenergyreport.ca. He's speaking to us from Calgary. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
My pleasure. Good to be with you again.
Can you tell us a bit about the Schachter Report and how our listeners can subscribe?
Yeah, the Schachter Energy Report was created in 2017 to cover the E&P and service sector of Canada. We've expanded to include royalty companies. We cover 33 companies right now, and we go everywhere from the biggest being Tourmaline all the way to some companies down below 2,000 BOEs a day, as well as service and others, and Canadian companies working in Canada, Canadian companies working around the world. And we cover companies that it's hard to get research on. And what we have is something called balance of evidence in our research, which talks about all of the good things we see going on in terms of, you know, upside with production, you know, insider buying, paying down debt. And then on the other side, we talk about issues of concern. If there's insider selling, too much debt, too high op costs, you know, lack of access to facilities, production delays, that kind of stuff. And then we talk about, you know, what would be a good price to buy the stock, what would be a good price to, you know, target for 1 year, and now to the end of the decade. And, you know, if you remember what we've been talking over the last while, we were cautious about the market in the beginning of the year. We thought inventories were growing.
and that we were going to probably see a pullback in the price of crude, which did occur. And then we also mentioned that in April, we got a buy signal, and we sent out a table-pounding buy. And people know about gold and how well it's done, but they don't seem to realize that the energy sector also had a very, very good run. I can give you some examples of that. You know, Surge Energy, a liquids producer, was up 70% from the April low to recent highs. Plus, you got a monthly dividend. Petrus up 42%, and you got a monthly dividend. Hemisphere up 40% with a nice one. The best performer, Inplay Oil, up 103% plus a monthly dividend. So you had some very, very good performance in the sector, and our subscribers, you know, have been involved and, you know, took advantage of it. I think right now we're a bit overbought. I think the price of oil, which is, you know, $64.60 or so today, probably will back off below $60 in the next month or two. And I think we might get another great buying opportunity at that point, and we'll send out a buy signal. So anyone wanting to, you know, become a subscriber, just go to our website. There's also, there's an annual format, and then there's a quarterly format, and you can buy the subscription and be up with what we're doing. And, you know, if you own, you know, the stocks, and you go to our website, there's three examples there of, you know, past research. You can see what we cover, how we cover, and then, of course, being a subscriber, you also get two complimentary tickets to our conference that we're having Saturday, October 18th here in Calgary at Mount Royal University. And we have signed up 39 companies to make presentations there, so people can get face time with the companies that they're interested in or they own. And that's really hard to get now because you don't have AGMs with face time. And, you know, getting a chance to go to a booth and talking to a Mike Rose at Tourmaline or Chris Carlson at Birchcliff or a Paul Coburn at Surge, that's something that's very hard to find and definitely stands out as one of the only conferences of its type for individual investors in Canada on the energy sector.
How can our listeners attend the conference on October 18th?
Well, they can either go to the to our website, the Schachter Energy Report, or the Catch the Energy website. You go to catchtheenergyconference.com, and then you can buy tickets there. But the best deal is probably to buy a subscription, the quarterly covers the effective costs of the two tickets, or you can get the subscription and have access to our research for a whole year. And that's really the key is, you know, the research really helps you to make better decisions and tell you when it's like green light, red light. You know, right now things are probably red light there because we're probably a little overheated here. But if we get a correction, the price of oil goes below 60, 56 to 58 range, we'll probably see stocks down 10, 15, 20% from where they are now, which would give you some great buying opportunities. Just like we banged table in April.
Crude continues to be in a trading range. Does it look like geopolitical unrest could take the price higher?
Geopolitical tensions could. For example, if we did see, NATO get involved directly with Russia, that would probably, be a flag that would get price of oil up, just like when, Russia invaded Ukraine and we have that pop up to, $120 or so. Disruption, if there is a, confrontation, then Russia probably would have, China and India would maybe not be buying so much. And so I think you'd see the price of oil run up there. The other one would be there's any, attacks on supply of any of the producers, anything happens with the Strait of Hormuz or Straits of Malacca, anytime you have disruption in logistics, that always pushes the price of oil up. So I'm in the camp that just on fundamentals in 2026, second half, we'll see $75, $80 oil. But if there is any kind of disruption of supply, and it's for any length of time, not just a day or two, but weeks, then you could be talking about, $90 or even $100 oil, depending upon how long it lasts and who caused the problem.
Natural gas is also in a trading range. When do seasonalities come into play for natural gas?
Well, natural gas is, you know, summer for the air conditioning demand and winter, of course, for heating and all the rest of it. So, you know, what I'm thinking is we're probably going to see natural gas firm up in November, December. And then I think we'll be, you know, instead of 70, 80 cents now for AECO, we'll probably be looking $2.50 to $3. And if we have a very cold winter with very big draws, we could see spikes up to, you know, $3, $4. The U.S. could see $4, $5 on spikes if we see very cold winter going down. If, of course, you see an Arctic front going down to Texas, you know it's very cold.
President Trump at the UN this week said climate change, it's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world. Your thoughts?
Look, we always have climate change. It gets warmer, it gets colder. We've had, you know, you just look at the long-term history of climate. There's, you know, it just happens all the time. And the seasonality is, you know, summer, you know, fall, you know, winter, you know, you have climate change through the seasons. So, you know, I think the fact of all the money that's been spent, the UN, you know, the committees they had on climate, you know, cherry-picked the data they wanted to make their case, and there's been a lot of, you know, issues coming out now saying that they fudged the numbers. So, you know, yes, there's climate change all the time, and, you know, we all take care of it. We heat our homes, you know, we insulate our homes, you know, wintertime we get used to driving in snow. So I think, you know, climate change is real, but I think the world is handling it. You know, the places where there really is a problem is those that are burning dirty coal. They've got to clean that up. But if you're, you know, if you see renewables, if you're seeing people using natural gas, you see more use of you know, going nuclear with the, you know, small reactors. I think, you know, the world is moving better and better. It's the countries that are still building and using coal-fired facilities that are the ones that have dirty skies. Fortunately, in Canada and the States, that's not the case.
This was a post from X this week. Carney rejects lifting the oil and gas emissions cap. Say goodbye to jobs. Say hello to depression. Canada is sitting on the third largest oil reserves in the world, and our PM treats it like toxic waste. Jobs gone, investment gone, prosperity gone. Your thoughts?
Well, I think the industry really would like to see, you know, Carney reverse some of the, you know, bills that were passed by Trudeau. You know, he's doing a little bit with, he's saying that we're prepared to have natural gas and more LNG plants on the West Coast. He's talking to Germany about, you know, selling gas to them, which would be like swaps where, you know, they would do a deal with Korea, South Korea or Japan or China, where a LNG tanker from BC would go to their country, and a tanker that was loaded with LNG in the Gulf of Mexico from the U.S. would end up going to Europe. So there's ways to do swaps to do that. On oil, you know, we're going to need another pipeline, but in the meantime, TMX still has capacity. You can do crude by rail. So even though, you know, Carney is still waving his anti-energy flag, I think he realizes if he wants to see Canada improve its economy, it needs to be moving forward. And that's why you saw those announcements of certain projects getting moved ahead. So we'll just have to wait and see. But, you know, it's only a small measure, and he's got a long distance to go before, you know, he's really turned on the engine and said, look, Canada's a resource country. We should be, you know, be producing our resources as environmentally, you know, the best in the world, in which we are. The industry is bringing in technology all the time to improve what they're doing, and then having First Nations buy-in. You know, so, you know, a lot of countries just ram through projects without taking everybody into account. Canada has a history now with what we've been doing of getting everybody to the table and making sure we do it in the best possible environmental and productive means possible.
Could Canada's Prime Minister be an economic hitman?
Well, you know, if we don't improve our economy and we don't, you know, create more jobs and we don't create more tax revenue so that the government at some point, and maybe in my grandkids' lifetime, will balance the budget, You could argue he is a hitman, you know, right now. The thing is, can he change his stripes? And, you know, instead of doing what he wants to do, he does what's right for Canada. You know, that requires the Prime Minister to bite the bullet and say, look, you know, I'm here to do the best possible job. I believe certain things, but I can't get them done. I better do what's best for Canada. The question is, you know, is he going to do that? We sure haven't seen enough to say that's the case.
China has put a huge tariff on Canadian canola. Could that canola be easily converted into biodiesel?
Well, you can make a biofuel out of canola, but again, it's not a cheap process to do. The canola can be used everywhere in the world for, you know, feed for animals. The canola oils, of course, we all can use for cooking. So, we are a big producer, billions of dollars for it. China at some point is going to need it. But again, you know, they want to have access to sell their BYD cars in Canada. And they also don't want us to be following the American flag and, you know, whenever the Americans say, you know, jump and the anti-China stuff, you know, do we follow along? They want to see us with an independent policy, and then maybe they can start negotiating on each of these subjects to come to a solution.
Are there bullish and bearish cases for crude?
Yeah, the bullish case is that, you know, the industry is not spending enough money worldwide, globally, to bring on enough new production to meet the demand that's going to be needed into the end of this decade. So the growth is going to be in the non-OECD. It'll be in Africa. It'll be South America, parts of Asia, where they're bringing on, you know, the lithium, the copper, the nickel, aluminum, all the things we need for the grid and for, you know, electrification, for, you know, data centers and for the, you know, growth in the economy longer term environmentally. So that's the bullish case. The bearish case is if we if the tariff war gets bad again, you start seeing economies roll over. But, you know, today, you know, we got data that the U.S. economy in the quarter, instead of growing at 3%, grew at 3.8%. So, you're beginning to see some better data. These interest rates, you know, are also ticking up a little bit, which, you know, is going to make the cost of debt servicing higher and harder for people to buy homes. So there's a bit of bullish and bearish in the mix here. At this point, I think that we don't have a clear pathway forward, but we do know that our resource-based Canadian economy is sitting in a very enviable spot, and our education system for people to get high-paying jobs in the AI world is there. The key thing is, do we not overdo it with immigration? Because the benefits and social services that are required and the quality of social services for Canadians isn't that great. Hospital delays for operations, getting in to see a specialist. You know, some people don't even have a GP, you know, a general practitioner doctor. So, you know, the system has, you know, blockages in education and medical care and social services. And, every time you open the door and bring in more people, it just makes it worse. So we need to, you know, figure out what do we need, train and educate and, you know, get more doctors to work in rural areas. You know, there's a lot of things we need to do. And yet the government, is swaying from one thing to another without dedicating sufficient resources to meet any of the needs.
What's the latest on rig data?
Well, right now you're seeing the data from that's last week, and the new data comes out tomorrow. But the U.S., the rig count for overall is down 7.8%, 542 rigs working down from 588. In Canada, we have 189 working down from 211, so down 10.4. But when you break it down between the mix, in the United States, the gas side, because of LNG, is up by about 23% because of the new plant, while oil is down 14.3, 418 down from 488. In Canada, both are down. Oil rig count now is 128 down from 144 a year ago, down 11%. And gas, of course, because of the cheap prices and nobody can make money, 60 rigs versus working 66. So we need higher commodity prices to get more production, but but we also need more takeaway capacity, and that's what we're all looking for, is to see that we get LNG Canada fully working on the one BCF, then bring on the second, the second one, and then the approval of with a final investment decision, FID on the next two BCF, and then all the other projects that were that are getting to FID, will be on in 27, 28, 29. So by the end of the decade, we'll become an important player in the LNG business, which will help our natural gas industry, and be very positive for Alberta and BC. But we're not there yet.
What's the latest on Canada trading crude and natural gas with the U.S. and Asia?
Well, right now the Americans are our biggest, we produce about 6.2 million barrels, and 3.7 or so of that goes to the U.S. We're now moving, about 800,000 or so, 700,000 or so, moving to 800,000 on the TMX line. So we need to, get more export away from the U.S., to grow our business, because we get a discount for selling into the States, more so on gas than both of them on the commodity side are, because the price in Canadian dollars versus 1.39 the U.S. dollar exchange rate. So even if we were the same parity, we'd still be at a big discount, and we're way below that. So I'm in the camp that we need to diversify. Going east, I don't think it's going to happen. Simply, we have gas pipelines into Ontario, but crossing Quebec and New Brunswick to and then ship it to Europe is not a go. I think what we're going to need to do is build more on the West Coast, and then do this this trading between the big boys out there. They can trade a cargo to go to Asia or a cargo to go to Europe. If there's a price differential, they do that now. So, if we build more LNG capacity, we will have the ability to export and benefit all Canadians.
What's the latest on oil and gas exploration in the Arctic and Antarctic?
Zero. The days of Dome Petroleum for the Arctic are not there. The U.S. is opening up parts of Alaska. I don't know if I've seen any discoveries come out of it yet. I think it's still early. They have to do seismic. They have to get the right equipment there. So Alaska will be much ahead of Canada. If you remember, Dome Petroleum found a lot of oil and gas up north. But, then they had the commission and no pipelines, and everybody was against it, or the majority of Canadians were against it. So Antarctica, I don't think there's anything going on there. I think it's more of a science place, but not for, I think you might see, southern parts of Argentina are focusing on oil and gas, but I think that's about as far south as you get.
Is new technology being used on old oil wells to get more oil out of the ground?
Yes, all the time. Between, conventional production might get, 10, maybe 15%. You use water flood and you use polymer flood, and you can probably get another 10 or 15 percentage points, depending upon who's doing it and how big the fields are and how porous the rock is. But new technology is being applied in the industry all the time. Companies like Hemisphere are using polymer floods in two main plays that they have in Alberta. We're hearing more and more of new technologies that are being coming up with by different people who are doing the chemistries. And so I think over time, the recovery rates will go up. And so what you want to do is find a field where there's still reservoir pressure, and then, increase the water, with water injection wells. Sometimes, that's what SAGD is. You see a, producing well, and you have two steam wells on either side to push the oil into the producing well. So the industry's always looking at new things and trying to, the steam oil ratio to get it lower, all of that helps the economics and make it worthwhile to continue to come up with new technologies and more production.
Alberta versus Texas in crude oil and natural gas. Where does Alberta accelerate and where does Texas accelerate?
Well, I think on the conventional oil and gas industry, Texas has a beat. The natural gas plays, the Montney, the Duvernay, they're as good as the Permian, and we have the technology to do it. Where Canada maybe stands out is the fact that the oil sands are there, and we're able to do it with either, the big, Syncrude facilities all the way to SAGD. So we are generating new technologies that are not being used in the States, because they're not going after shale as much as we are on shale oil, but they are, except for the Permian and other plays in mostly in the Texas area.
Could the purchasing of crude oil and natural gas from Russia by European Union countries lead to the end of the unelected EU?
Well, right now on terms of crude oil, Hungary and Slovakia are still buyers. I gather Spain, France, and a couple other countries are still buying natural gas. So when they talk about putting in more sanctions, President Trump has said, hey, you guys clean up your own act before you ask me to put punishing secondary sanctions on Russia. Trump's taken a 180 here. He thought that Putin would play ball because they were buddies. And now he realized that's not the case, and now he's going all in with Ukraine and saying, "Hey, Ukraine might even be able to take back all the territory that was taken by Russia." I think that's a big change for the U.S. And Ukraine is attacking refineries, energy infrastructure, military targets, and Russia seems to be saying, "Let's we're not going after the same. We're going after civilian targets." It's just stupid. If Russia really thought they wanted to win the war, you take out the military capability of the opposition. They're not doing that. And, bombing civilians and is just making, it's like the Battle of Britain. It just made the British more resolute that they were going to stay and not acquiesce to, the Nazi invasion.
Stock markets continue to hit new highs and more new highs with all the things going on in the world. Could these stock markets be climbing a wall of worry?
I think that, you saw the announcement from the Fed chairman that he thought prices were high. He didn't use Greenspan's irrational exuberance. But when you look at the valuations, multiples of revenue, multiples of profitability, multiples of cash flow, all the numbers are in the stratosphere. We're more expensive than we were in 2000, with dot-com bubble. I think we're ready for a tumble here. I think even, if we do see a, 5,000 points off the NASDAQ, we're already seeing NVIDIA roll over. And so if we see more of that happening, we could be looking at a fourth quarter where we see a nasty correction. And just like when we had January, February, March, where the market came down, and in April we got a buy signal for energy and we said buy, and the stocks, as I mentioned earlier, did very, very well. I think this possibility we might get, a 20% market correction in the Dow and the NASDAQ and the S&P, energy will come down as well, and then we'll get another buy signal for our area, my area, and that probably will be the same time as you'll get a buy area for the high flyers, the M7 and the AI stocks, which have had tremendous, tremendous runs. But I think the bubble is going to burst.
The Fed and the Bank of Canada both cut their bank rates last week by a quarter point. Is this likely to affect energy markets?
Well, lower interest rates means that, companies have less interest expense if they have debt on their balance sheets. I don't think it impacts demand at all. I'm concerned that we're seeing the U.S. dollar strengthen here. And if the next week we end up with the government being shut down, I think we're going to see a more higher rising interest rate, because people will be concerned that the whole process of running the U.S. government is out of whack, And if the Republicans give in to the Democrats on all of the social spending they want, that means the deficit is going to go up by hundreds of billions of dollars, which is going to be negative for interest rates too, because you've got to borrow more, you got to refinance the maturing issues. All of that, will be, suffocating other borrowers. And if any of those issues, if we start seeing the bid to cover ratio, number of bids to cover is lower and lower, then all of a sudden people will realize at some point if there's a revolt by the bond buyers, the bond vigilantes, as they say, and they say we're not buying the paper, the yield's not high enough, that could cause a real crisis for the market, the stock markets and the bond market.
Even though bank rates are going lower, could mortgage rates actually go higher?
Yeah, the bank rates are short-term money, like the prime rate, and that it really doesn't affect long rates. And, we did see quarter-point decline, and we did see mortgage rates come down a little bit. But, in Canada, we're a little different in the way we have our mortgages versus the States, which are 10-year or 30-year mortgages. And those mortgages, even though the U.S. did lower them, mortgage rates went up in the state, so and long bond rates of 10-year and 30-year went up. So, it depends. Each country is separate and different. If we drop another 50 basis points in Canada, mortgages will be a little bit cheaper. We'll break 4%, and that would be, helpful. The problem is the cost. Housing costs and affordability is a problem that doesn't go away with a 50 basis point cut in the rate of the mortgage. You got to have a massive amount of money for a down payment if you're a first-time buyer, and then the monthly, the cost of servicing that debt, is going to be high. So, in markets like Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, for first-time buyers who don't have help from their families, it's unlikely they'll ever own a home. And that's the same thing you see in Europe. A lot of European cities, 50-60% of the population don't own their own homes, they're renters. And because they're just squeezed out by price.
There's talk President Trump is going to move the U.S. debt into stable coin. What are you hearing?
Well, he was against it in his first term, and now, of course, he's making a lot of money with all the Trump coins that his kids are involved in. And, so he's taken 180 degrees versus term one to term two. 45 to 47 presidencies. The U.S. debt, if it's gold-backed, I think people will jump on it. If it's backed by, Bitcoin or, stablecoin or whatever, I'm not so sure you're going to see, institutional buyers, heading to buy this stuff right away. They're buying the inflation protected bonds tips, and they're buying, if it was a gold backed currency, they would probably jump all over it. I'm not sure if the countries are ready and trusting enough. It's the young people and more aggressive investors are going into that area. But mom and pop on Main Street or down, in rural America, small town America, or Canada, they're not going near it.
The U.S. dollar continues in a trading range that it's been in since July. Where do you think the U.S. dollar goes from here?
I'm in the camp that if interest rates go up, which I think they will, if the economy is strong, if the deficits get bigger, I think the U.S. is going to have to pay more to borrow to service the debt, to get new buyers. So if that happens, the U.S. dollar, after going down for many, many months, we're already seeing in the last week or two a little of life in the U.S. dollar. I think, getting back to par, back to 100, I think is possible sometime, in the next 6 months. And if that's the case, the Canadian dollar will retreat. We're already seeing it. I think at the beginning of the week, the exchange rate was 1.38. Now we're 1.39. We could be 1.42, especially if oil goes below 60. So I think we're looking at a stronger U.S. dollar, slightly weaker or weaker Canadian dollar. Euro, I think, is going to go down hard because of all the problems in Europe. And if there's a war and they put capital controls on, that's going to be pretty shitty for investors in Europe.
The Canadian dollars continued in a trading range for a few months. Now it's kind of looking weak. What do you see for the Canuck buck?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think we break, we break down from here. We could go, below 70 again if price of oil goes below 60 and the U.S. dollar is very strong. And if there's a war expansion in Europe, a flight of capital will go to the U.S., which will strengthen the U.S. dollar. And that would hurt Canada, especially because the interest rates in the States are higher than Canada. So could we see a 68, 69 cent dollar, Canadian dollar, against the U.S. in the next 6 months? I think that's a higher and higher probability now.
Is AI likely to cause an electricity shortage going forward?
It already is. Many of the grids are running at full capacity. There's articles now where, electricity rates for individuals and homeowners has gone up sharply. And it's because the grid is, being pushed into, data centers and they're doing it under long-term contracts. So the spot market that, you and I pay gets higher. So I think that there's going to be a backlash against this area. And, to build new capacity, be it natural gas-fired or nuclear-fired, all of that's going to increase the price of electricity. And the question is, who pays for it? If, governments are willing to allow utilities to do long-term contracts at cheap prices, which is, of course, what they want to do, just like when, people are building these coin farms, you want the cheapest price of electricity. And, for a while, Alberta had cheap electricity, not so much anymore. I think this is going to be a very big issue and a very big political issue going forward. As the cost of power goes up, people are going to say, why are we subsidizing industry? And that's going to be a problem.
If drones and cyber attacks are the future of warfare, why are countries drafting soldiers other than to decrease the population?
That's a nasty one. Look, I think that, if you want to defend yourself and you're on the border with an attacking country, be it Russia or, if it's, Taiwan protecting themselves against China aggression, North Korea, South Korea, you're going to need soldiers, to slow things down. Drones and cyber attacks, can't stop an invading army, that well. And there's now a lot of things that you can do with EMPs to, throw drones off, so that they lose their satellite control. So I think there's, anti-drone military capabilities are picking up here. And I bet you that, the love affair with drones may be, it may be very good for gathering intelligence and for maybe, bombing small units. But if there's a major attack with, thousands of them, then a defending area might be able to use an EMP attack against them and just have them fall out of the sky.
President Trump has designated Antifa as a terrorist organization and alluded more designations to come. Antifa is in Canada. Do you think Mark Carney will be forced to follow Trump's lead?
I don't know. Is Mark Carney a member of Antifa? He's so left-wing, or was more left-wing before he got into power. I don't think Canada would do it. We're just not that kind of democracy. We are limiting free speech, as you know, with one of those bills where you can't say anything that the government doesn't want on the energy side. We're seeing, Rebel News bring up issues all across Canada where the left is getting away with stuff, the right isn't. And also the government isn't willing to face any of these problems. And they're still going after the people from the truckers, movement into Ottawa. So the left wing in Canada, is where the Liberal Party's base is. And so they're not going to change. They're not going to be following the U.S. at all.
Do you think there would be benefits for Alberta to become the 51st state?
I don't see that. Look, Alberta and Saskatchewan, if the federal government became so anti-energy and the benefits that Alberta and Saskatchewan give in terms of the payments, to Ottawa to go to largesse to Quebec and others, and Atlantic Canada, I think that at some point, there might be a momentum for a separation and a vote, but I don't see that now. I don't see it in the next few years. I think it's going to take a massive amount of anti-Western moves by the federal government, and also no support from Ontario and other provinces to say Alberta and Saskatchewan have a reason to be upset, and let's try to find a solution. If it's East versus West, and then we could see something happen where there's a vote. But going and joining the states is a bridge too far.
How well do you think Alberta would do as a country of 5.5, a landlocked country of 5.5 million?
Well, we do have a lot of resources here, be it energy, be it agriculture, be it forest products, in technology wise, medical care, research. I think Switzerland is landlocked and it's worked for them. And we have pipelines to take away our energy. So, I don't think it's going to happen, but I think that right now I think we're sitting in a position here where the federal government realizes that they have to do things that are going to, improve the economy, and that means the West has to be part of that solution.
This week, President Trump and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. were focused on autism, Tylenol, and vaccines. Do you think this is just the beginning of finding out what's been hidden from people for decades?
Well, autism really has taken off big time in the last couple of decades. Vaccines, we've all had them as kids, for smallpox and all kinds of things when we were very little. It sure didn't hurt us to be, vaccinated. I think that there's got to be a lot more research, but I think that, Kennedy has a big bias here and talks out of his mouth without knowing what his brain doesn't talk to his mouth, in terms of, realizing what he's saying. I think that there's a lot more research that has to be done, but autism is, and other diseases are picking up bacterial infections. We're seeing, more issues with, are we going to see other COVID type of things come in the decades ahead, as the biological weapons created by somebody. So I think that we need to have independent research chase these things down rather than have pontificators talking out of their mouth without their brain attached to it.
Are the demographics changing in the big Alberta cities as a lot of people are moving out? Any thoughts on where those people are moving to?
I think I would argue the demographics are favorable. Alberta probably has got some of the biggest immigration into the province, for a number of reasons. One, there's jobs. Number two, there's good education. Number three, housing is cheap. So people are moving into Alberta, Edmonton, Calgary. When I moved to Alberta in the 70s, there was 300,000 people in Edmonton, 200,000 in Calgary. I think both cities are 1.2, 1.3 million. I think Calgary bigger than Edmonton. And then Red Deer's grown. So we're seeing more and more people moving in. You see job ads everywhere. There's been times when we've had a shortage of workers, in service industries. So I think that, we're going to see more migration every year, and hopefully it's educated people who bring talent that's needed in the province. And I think the government of Alberta is being very outspoken about saying, we want people to come. If you can bring your skills and your efforts and your hard work, and pick up the language and fit in, come on over.
Does Alberta still have that tax break for certain skills?
I know that wage rates here are pretty good compared to other provinces, and our cost of living is lower. So the net opportunity for families to do well in Alberta is there.
One thing, Joseph, I was born in Alberta and grew up there. I still can't get used to sales taxes being charged in other provinces.
Yeah, I know. I
still
too.
Can't get used to it.
Yeah, we pay GST here, but that's my point. Hmm. It's even worse going to Europe because you pay the damn VAT.
Could there be black swans in our future?
Oh, yeah. And, every time there's something that comes in, be it COVID or Trump's crazy tariff thing that he did, those black swans, take away confidence. And markets are based on confidence. Right now, the markets are, going back a couple weeks ago, were euphoric because everybody had confidence. AI was going to, take over the world. America was a leader, you were seeing defense spending pick up and, rah-rah America, and then you can have things change when, something happens geopolitically that could change things. Something in the economy could go bad. We could be looking at watching the employment data to see, are we really losing jobs to AI? You see some of these AI leaders that say, we're going to lose 50% of the white-collar jobs. And then you look at even the service sector, you're seeing Starbucks announce they're going to close a lot of their locations, lay off people, and you're seeing other companies do it. So, if we do see something happen on the employment side, something geopolitical, something that's a black swan, a bust of the bubble in AI, because people say, well, we're spending all this money, tens of hundreds of billions of dollars on AI, and all of a sudden they say, oops, I'm not making any money for all this spend. That could be a wake-up call that's a black swan.
Where can our listeners subscribe to the Schachter Energy Report and find out more about your energy conference October 18th?
Yeah, they can go to schachterenergyreport.ca. That's our website, and they could, become, Google, Schachter Energy Report, and they could go to our website, and then they can see copies of our research, and they could get, if they buy it before the 18th, they could come to Calgary and get two tickets complimentary to come to the conference. If they just want to come to the conference, go to the catchtheenergyconference.com, and then they can buy tickets there to come to the conference. So it's a fabulous conference, FaceTime with top management in the energy industry, and that's the only conference of its type in Canada. So if you are invested in the energy sector, coming FaceTime and getting the ability to talk to companies that you own and ask questions will give you more comfort and more confidence to own the names, and you'll maybe find some new names that you want to buy when we get our next buy signal, and having our research will help you fine-tune that.
Joseph, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure as always, Jim.
My guest has been Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report online at schachterenergyreport.ca. He was speaking to us from Calgary. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Rick Ackerman, and Joseph Schachter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.